W1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Pro-Palestinian protests today at college graduations. Like this one at the University of Michigan this weekend and at the University of Texas Austin campus this afternoon. Protesters calling for the university to divest from investments with ties to Israel and for the university president to resign. A protest encampment at USC was cleared today without incident. Also in Texas, heavy rain in northern counties since Tuesday. It's threatening to increase flooding to Hurricane Harvey levels. Oklahoma and Arkansas could also get soaked. Connecticut, a Herculean effort to get I-95 reopened after a fiery collision that compromised an overpass at overhead bridge cleared. And the highway reopened today, less than 80 hours after the incident. Madonna staged the world's largest free concert in the Copacabana Beach in Rio de Janeiro in front of a reported 1.6 million fans. This is ABC News. At least 75 people killed during a landslide in Brazil's Rio Grande do Sul. It happened during what authorities say is the worst flooding in 80 years. The controversy over South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem's new book continues after some eyebrow-raising over a chapter where she talks about shooting her dog. Now a claim in the book that she met with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, which experts say didn't and could not have happened. Noem telling CBS News Face the Nation that some edits have now been made in the book.
This is an anecdote that I asked to have removed because I think it's appropriate at this point in time. But I'm not going to talk to you about those personal meetings that I've had with world leaders.
Millions of Orthodox Christians worldwide are celebrating Orthodox and Greek Easter on this Sunday. The Greek Orthodox Church uses the Julian calendar, not the Gregorian calendar, that most other Christian believers use. And Greek Easter is also dictated by the Hebrew calendar because it always falls after Passover. I'm Dave Packer, ABC News.
Most of us agree that every Wisconsinite deserves affordable health care. California mega millionaire Eric Hovde does not. Hovde said he would repeal the Affordable Care Act, quote, in its entirety. What? The Affordable Care Act protects people from insurance companies refusing coverage for pre-existing conditions and stops them from dropping your coverage if you get sick. If Eric Hovde got his way, millions of Americans could get hit with increases in their healthcare premiums of 20% or more. Millions more could lose coverage altogether. Hovde even spoke out against parents helping their kids by keeping them on their health insurance plans until they turn 26. Now that might be okay for Eric Hovde. His businesses have raked in millions of dollars in handouts. But it doesn't cut it for hardworking Wisconsinites and our families. Call Eric Hovde at his California office, 714-730-4444. Tell him we support lower health care costs. Paid for by Better Wisconsin Together Incorporated.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. An AARP study finds 1 in 5 Americans 50 and older has nothing saved for retirement. Wisconsin workers are being urged to save now to avoid financial stress later. Mike Moan reports.
Just affording basic expenses right now is a concern for many, but AARP's Jim Flaherty says you don't want to be caught off guard when retirement nears. He acknowledges it can be hard for younger adults to plan that far ahead when they're juggling expenses like student loan debt, or for older individuals managing costly medications and higher grocery bills.
A lot of times because they're just trying to get by, and they do have to live paycheck to paycheck. But this is one way to say, hey, if you can live with a little bit less from your paycheck every week, that will sure grow.
Researchers note that 57 million Americans don't have access to a retirement plan through their work. Wisconsin has not yet joined the list of states that have created state-operated retirement accounts where employers and their workers can contribute money each pay period. Supporters hope the issue is revisited next legislative session. Flaherty says a combination of individuals being proactive and policymakers easing household budget pressure can hopefully put more people on a path toward a healthy retirement. He says making progress can deter them from looking elsewhere to spend their golden years.
Let's have an infrastructure that makes drugs affordable, that makes healthcare affordable, that makes retirement savings something that's part of their plan, and that'll keep Wisconsinites here.
And groups like AARP have encouraged Congress to address long-term stability concerns for Social Security so that younger workers can anticipate full benefits. Some Republican lawmakers have floated cuts, but senior advocates contend that any solutions to make the program stronger should not be tied to deficit talks. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Plenty of sunshine today, a few high clouds and upper 60s, a light and variable wind. Overnight, mostly clear and mid-40s. On Monday, sunshine, upper 60s. By Tuesday, a chance of showers, some thunderstorms around as well, especially late in the day. Highs in the mid-60s. It's 57 at our studios.
John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
It's producer Amanda. On the next Mino and the Mayor, the guys are joined by Frank Hermans, who has a new show at the Meyer. And the folks from Caribbean Taste Food Truck in Appleton are in our small business spotlight.
Mino and the Mayor, weekday mornings 6 till 9.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, and I am your host for, yes, this second hour of our weekend broadcast. This is our weekly weekend assessment, a review, our analysis of things like government actions and legal principles, and yes, indeed, the aspiration for justice in our nation and beyond. Thank you so much for joining me for this, our second hour. As always, we are taking your phone calls as well at 844-967-2789. You can also get into our program and engage in our discussions through the Civic Media app. Again, 844-967-2789. My wonderful producer, Kelvin, and I here ready to take your inquiries, your questions about the many different areas on our syllabus this weekend. Thank you. Thank you for once again joining us for this discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review. We are talking, as we always do, about the United States Supreme Court. They issue opinions at this time of year that have dramatically changed and sometimes not changed the very geography of our nation. Appropriate to understand that of the 62 cases on the docket of the Supreme Court in this, its 2023-2024 term, 62 cases the Supreme Court has decided it will review. It has already issued opinions in 18 of those. 18 of those cases already the subject of its opinions. And so, for example, we have talked on this broadcast about a recent decision of the Supreme Court in a case called Muldrow versus City of St. Louis. A unanimous decision, keep that in mind, an important aspect of this. All nine justices determining in the end that workers can indeed pursue employment discrimination claims over job transfers, movements inside their employment, without having to show that an involuntary move with which they disagreed caused some significant disadvantage, like harm to career prospects or a change in salary or rank. What that means is, again, that under Title VII, the options for showing employment discrimination in the terms and conditions of employment are broader, or at least now that they are defined under Muldrow versus City of St. Louis, according to all the members, all of them, all nine of them unanimously agreed to this broader understanding of the circumstances under which employment discrimination claims can be made. We know as well that nine of the justices, all of them unanimously, in a case called O'Connor-Ratcliffe versus Garnier and Linkey versus Freed, actually two cases brought together, they said this about social media, focus a lot on social media, this docket. Public officials, they said, can be liable for blocking or deleting their critics from their social media accounts, but only when they're acting in an official capacity and with actual authority from the government for which they work to speak on behalf of that government. In this pair of unanimous decisions, again, the court said that public officials are still private citizens with their own constitutional rights, but if information is accessible only on those personal accounts and a public official blocks a critic, prevents them from getting access to it, that's when That's when rights to constitutional access to information can, in fact, be unconstitutional. A significant case, again, O'Connor Ratcliffe, and Linke versus Freed. That also decided. And a third case I'll highlight again this weekend, also unanimous, which, again, is a part of the appropriate identification of what's going on here. We're getting a lot of cases where they all agree. So those are coming out now. A case, of course, as you know, ballot eligibility for Donald Trump. Colorado cannot disqualify Donald Trump, could not disqualify Donald Trump because of his actions before and during the January 6th attack. And that decision issued way back in March. Justice said that the Constitution does not permit a single state to bar a presidential candidate from national office. And they declared instead that the responsibility rests exclusively with the Congress and not the states, keeping Donald Trump on the docket there in Colorado and across the United States of America. Other states also looking to that. So three cases among the 14 highlighting this weekend here on our broadcast, but many others undecided. We'll give you some sampling this weekend and in the weekends ahead of what we're still anticipating from the Supreme Court. It is going to be a busy time. This is the time, mid-May. Into mid-June, approximately, when the Supreme Court starts to issue some of the decisions. We have talked already again on this weekend broadcast about this case, Trump versus United States, the immunity case. That will be coming out highly, highly unlikely, depending upon what they decide, that that will be a unanimous decision. It appears that six members of our Supreme Court may be going in the direction of identifying this bifurcated analysis where there are some areas where if they're official conduct, if there is official acts, that those might be protected by some concept of immunity. But if they're personal, those are not. A distinction, again, that I and many others who look at this from not only a legal perspective, but also a broad constitutional and republic, future of the republic position, view as ridiculous, as a position that cannot be embraced. We will see what the Supreme Court does. That one, very highly controversial, argued just on April 25th. We know as well there's another case that we have talked about on this broadcast, Fisher versus United States. Doesn't involve Donald Trump by name, but plainly implicates once again this prosecution pending against him right now in the federal district court in the District of Columbia, alleging election interference, four counts there brought by a federal indictment. That case suspended while the Supreme Court determines whether or not there is immunity in that other case. And also, arguably, depending upon what they do in Fisher, that could also have an impact upon not only the prosecutions, the convictions of hundreds of people that have been prosecuted and sentenced and in many cases incarcerated under a particular statute. And the question there in Fisher is whether prosecutors properly charged them, and arguably, derivatively, whether the grand jury in the Trump case properly charged Donald Trump using a law that makes it a crime to obstruct or impede an official proceeding. In this case, the disruption of Congress's certification of the 2020 election results. We know that well from what we saw on January 6th. The question is whether or not the statute applies. That's Fisher. That was argued on April 16th. We will see. We will see what the Supreme Court does. It appears there from the tea leaves that a majority of the Supreme Court, as we have said previously, the majority of the Supreme Court in the Fisher case appears inclined to say that the application of Section 1512, which is the statute under which Mr. Fisher and others, and yes, indeed, Donald Trump has also been prosecuted, is not applicable, at least to on-the-ground activities. Question whether or not the statute is applicable to the charges against Donald Trump in the other discrete case against him. That will be the subject of even more litigation, depending upon what the Supreme Court says. The third major case coming out of the Supreme Court having to do with Donald Trump. Other things we're also anticipating in the area of guns as well. Guns for suspected domestic abusers. This is the Rahimi case, United States versus Rahimi. An argument held way back on November 7th. The question there, the big gun case on the docket of the Supreme Court this term, whether a law, a federal law, disarming individuals who are subject to domestic violence protective orders issued by state courts, whether that violates the Second Amendment. There is a federal law that prohibits anyone, again, under the Second Amendment, one of those situations where the Second Amendment, not unconditional, has restrictions on it. A federal law that has been upheld up to this point that says if you are subject to a domestic violence restraining order, you cannot possess a weapon. You can't hold one. You can't use one. You can't sell one or transfer one. And Mr. Rahimi, challenging that in this case, argued before the Supreme Court back in November, questioned whether or not the Supreme Court will uphold that federal law in one of its major guns cases. And it appears that they are poised, that is the nine members of the Supreme Court, poised probably to allow that ban to remain in place. This is a bridge too far, especially with the facts from Mr. Rahimi and his particular conduct. We'll see what the Supreme Court does in the Rahimi case having to do with the intersection between federal law and this domestic violence restraining order situation. Another big case we're still waiting for a decision on. This is called Garland. Yes, that's our Attorney General. Garland versus Cargill. This is the bump stock ban. The bump stock ban. You call this case is whether a federal ban on bump stocks, that is when attached to rifles, these devices, as you know well, speed up how quickly bullets can be fired from a firearm, whether that's permitted under federal law. And the question is whether or not bump stocks are firearms. And the fact that they're attached to firearms to increase the velocity to how quickly these bullets can be fired, whether that renders them subject to review, analysis, and regulation by the ATF and the federal government generally. A federal ban on bump stocks implemented by the Trump administration continued under the Biden administration. We all recall well the Las Vegas gunman, 2017, killing dozens of people, the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history there in Las Vegas. That was a bump stock case, and that's what prompted the regulation now being challenged in the Supreme Court. Determined sometime in Garland versus Cargill whether or not bump stocks are illegal in the United States or whether the prohibition on them violates the Second Amendment. Then we've got all sorts of abortion cases, which is also going to lead us to our discussion this weekend about what's happened in two of our states. We've got this case called FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. Remember this case? Argument not too long ago, March 26. The question there, whether to restrict access to this key abortion medication used predominantly in the United States along with a secondary pharmaceutical. It's called mifepristone. It's used in more than half of all U.S. abortions and was first approved by the FDA way back in 2000. Abortion medication, of course, has increased in importance as more than a dozen states have restricted or banned abortion since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. That number approaching even 20 now these days in the wake of the Supreme Court decision in Dobbs. This question of mifepristone, much related to the Dobbs decision. And the question is whether or not the FDA decision to permit that drug to be in the public domain, the authorization by the FDA back in 2000, tested and analyzed ever since then, in the quarter century since then, whether the FDA should be second-guessed. It appears that the courts seemed unlikely to restrict the access to that drug, mifepristone, but we will also be taking a look at that as well. More of this analysis, a brief review of what the Supreme Court has in its docket coming up as we continue here on our weekend broadcast, Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
It seems like the cost of everything is going up, so it's nice to save a little dough when you can, especially for something you love to eat every day. Before I go grocery shopping, I print out a coupon for $1 off any Country Hearth, Village Hearth, or Artisan Hearth bread product. My favorite is Dakota Style 12 grain. My wife's breakfast go-to is a toasted Village Hearth English muffin. We can save a buck on each. Go to countryhearthbreads.com/coupons and print one or two out before your next shopping trip. And don't forget, Country Hearth, Village Hearth, and Artisan Hearth bread products are baked locally and delivered fresh daily.
An unsuspecting driver at a gas station in Wisconsin. Welcome, Pump 15. How you doing?
Great.
Were you wearing your seatbelt today?
I never wear my seatbelt.
We're going to get him. We're going to get him real good.
Oh, my goodness.
Hello, sir. How you doing? Dollar driver. It takes 1 second to strap a seatbelt on. Well, let's do this. Let's do it together. Now, don't that feel better?
Donald Driver can't always be there to remind you.
Click it or ticket.
And let's reduce fatalities on Wisconsin roadways.
And I should have recognized your voice when you're harassing
I'm watching you.
Sponsored by Wisconsin DOT.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review, and we are talking in this segment of our weekend broadcast about what we can anticipate from the United States Supreme Court in the weeks just ahead. Yes, the next 5, 6, maybe 7 weeks out there, going to be populated by lots and lots of decisions in many different areas of our lives and livelihoods, as the Supreme Court has done virtually every year in our contemporary lives, deciding major cases. This is the time period. Early, mid, late May, into June especially, early June especially, a hot period of time for the Supreme Court to begin to issue these decisions, including as we were talking about cases involving reproductive rights, privacy rights under the Constitution, all of that, in the wake of the decision almost 2 years ago now, June of 2022, and a decision issued by the majority, not a unanimous verdict, not a unanimous judgment by the Supreme Court, but by an opinion written by Sam Alito, finding that the privacy rights, to the extent that they adhere at all in the Constitution, do not extend to abortion rights, to reproductive rights. That, of course, is the Dobbs decision that has changed dramatically what is happening in America with respect to abortion rights and access. We talked already about this major case, FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, determining in the wake of that decision whether or not the drug mifepristone, in the wake of Dobbs, and it's no longer finding this position of privacy rights in the Constitution for abortion, whether the FDA's decision to authorize that drug as reasonably safe and secure, whether that should continue, likely that the Supreme Court will afford the FDA the discretion that it has exercised in finding that it is, for the most part, a safe and secure drug tested over a couple of decades and more, likely that mifepristone will be affirmed, if you will, in that sense, by the Supreme Court, overturning a lower appellate court and certainly a district court judge that found that mifepristone was not properly administered and overseen by the FDA. There is another case that's also pending in the area of privacy rights and reproductive rights, abortion rights, and that's Idaho versus United States. We've talked about this on our weekend broadcast as well. Oral argument held just recently, April 24th. The case, once again, Idaho versus United States. The question there, whether a federal law requiring emergency room care for life-threatening cases means that emergency room doctors in states across the country that have strict abortion bans must nonetheless terminate those pregnancies in certain circumstances. The Biden administration taking the view that this federal law requires that medical doctors in ER situations preserve the vitality and sustenance of women when their lives are being threatened and are obliged to perform those abortions to continue to address their health situations. In a situation like Idaho, in that particular state, it has passed a law, a state law, that prohibits abortion entirely. And the question is, which one of those holds? The Supreme Court, again, hearing argument on this case on April 24th, determining, again, whether or not the federal law will be supreme over the state law. The assumption is that the federal law, pursuant to the Supremacy Clause, will hold, and that the interpretation given that law by the Biden administration will indeed supersede, if you will, the status of the state case, the state law in Idaho that prohibits abortions entirely. Very significant abortion case pending there in the Supreme Court, having to do with the intersection between state law and federal law when it comes to abortion. Many other cases also pending in future broadcasts of this program. We will talk about those other things as they're coming up. And certainly we will also discuss the cases as they are decided by the Supreme Court. We are talking, therefore, about the cases before the Supreme Court having to do with abortion. And indeed, because of the wake of the decision in the Dobbs case, we know that a lot of the decision-making has gone on now in the states. You know a lot about that. There's been happening for 2 years, ever since the Supreme Court decided that Dobbs case in June of 2022, focusing this weekend on Amicus Law Review on two states in particular. Lots of activity just this past week in the states of Arizona and also Florida. Arizona lawmakers just this past Wednesday repealed an abortion ban that first became law when Abraham Lincoln was president and a half century before women won the right to vote. Now, where do we get to that? How do we get to that point in Arizona where this major thing happened? What are the implications? What does this look like going ahead? Well, a recent Supreme Court decision there in the state of Arizona. This is the state Supreme Court, not the federal Supreme Court. Ruling by 4-2, they upheld the 1864 law that prohibited virtually all abortion procedures. They said physicians are now on notice that all abortions, except those necessary to save a woman's life, are illegal. Now, needless to say, that prompted a lot of reaction on all sides of the political aisle when it comes to this hotbed issue of abortion and privacy rights, not just in Arizona, but also across the country. The state attorney general there said she's going to decline criminal prosecutions of doctors and others, describing the ruling of the Supreme Court as unconscionable and an affront to freedom. On the other side of the docket, you have a group called the Alliance Defending Freedom saying, we celebrate now the decision that allows the state's pro-life law to again protect the lives of countless innocent unborn children. So what happens? Well, in the wake of that, putting this 1864 law back into place, or simply affirming its applicability there in Arizona, by a 16-14 vote, the state Senate just this past week, with the support of every Democratic senator and, yes, two Republicans, this is a bipartisan 16-14 vote, repealed that 19th century law. And the governor, her name is Katie Hobbs there in Arizona, she signed that bill. And as a result of that, the state will now be governed by a 2022 law, another law that was passed, obviously long after the 1864 law, but following Dobbs, that prohibits abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Interestingly and concerningly, no rape or incest exceptions in that law. So the 2022 law now becomes the state law in Arizona almost. And why do I say that? Well, the repeal of the 1864 law by virtue of Arizona law does not become effective until 90 days after the legislature adjourns. It has repealed the 1864 law, but the repeal of that doesn't become effective for 90 more days, which means that more than technically, right now, the 1864 law remains in place. It will go out of applicability, effectiveness, 90 days after they leave, and the 2022 law goes into effect. We will talk more about all of that and also talk about the state of Florida here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Pro-Palestinian protests today at college graduations. Like this one at the University of Michigan this weekend and at the University of Texas Austin campus this afternoon. Protesters calling for the university to divest from investments with ties to Israel and for the university president to resign. A protest encampment at USC was cleared today without incident. Also in Texas, heavy rain in northern counties since Tuesday. It's threatening to increase flooding to Hurricane Harvey levels. Oklahoma and Arkansas could also get soaked. Connecticut, a Herculean effort to get I-95 reopened after a fiery collision that compromised an overpass at overhead bridge cleared. And the highway reopened today, less than 80 hours after the incident. Madonna staged the world's largest free concert in the Copacabana Beach in Rio de Janeiro in front of a reported 1.6 million fans. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Cubs had a 5-0 lead, but Milwaukee came back scoring 4 in the 7th, another run in the 8th. The Cubs come out on top with a 6-5 win in front of over 40,000 at sold-out Wrigley Field. Cubs manager Craig Counsell asked, what's it been like facing his former team, the Brewers?
There are people there that I have really good relationships with, and look, you miss people for sure. I mean, I miss people over there, absolutely. You know, when you see people that you've spent a lot of time with and you miss them, like, yeah, absolutely. That's what kind of brings the emotion to it.
Pat Murphy was Council's coach in college, then his bench coach, before taking over as the Brewers manager.
Big series like this, whether some of it is blown out of proportion or not, doesn't matter. I think it's great. You know, it's great for young players like we have. You know what I mean? What an awesome thing.
That's Brewers manager Pat Murphy. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Plenty of sunshine today, a few high clouds and upper 60s, a light and variable wind. Overnight, mostly clear and mid-40s. On Monday, sunshine, upper 60s. By Tuesday, a chance of showers, some thunderstorms around as well, especially late in the day. Highs in the mid-60s. It's 57 at our studios.
Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected to your local community. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
If you hear a siren, it could be a response for help after a fall. Oshkosh Fire Chief Mike Stanley says it's the number one reason for calls to his department.
Much more significantly than we respond to fires, to heart attacks, car accidents, you know, traumatic injuries. You know, we're going on fall calls, you know, more often than not.
Stanley hopes a new partnership with the company behind a free balance training app, Nimble, NYMBL, can help seniors avoid falls by improving balance with exercises from the app.
I can do this from my home. I can do this from my living room, you know, so that I don't have to worry about securing a ride to go somewhere.
Look for more information going out with water bills across Oshkosh this month. Until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
The Todd Alba Show.
Terry Barr, host of Slice of Wisconsin here on Civic Media. Mr. Zommers, what is that called?
My Wife is Drunk by Terry's favorite, Alvin Stasinski.
There you go.
Yeah. It's so funny to listen to a polka because you think, where did that song come from?
Right? We actually had one person text during the break there said, how about the Meadow Muffin Polka?
Todd, let's quickly write that and make it.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we talk to retired Major General Randy Manner about Project 2025 and what that could mean to American democracy. Hour number 2, cars versus deer. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
A This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for these remaining segments on our weekend review of now talking about abortion in America, talking specifically about major events in two states, in Arizona, and yes, in just a moment or so, Florida, things that happened in the wake of the 2022 decision by the Supreme Court saying that there no longer is, if ever there was, a position inside, vested inside the Supreme Court that establishes a privacy right to reproductive rights and abortion. Talking about the situation in Arizona, where just this past week, the governor signed legislation repealing this 19th century law that imposed a prohibition on virtually all abortion procedures, effectively now going into effect 90 days after the legislature leaves and moves on to other things. And also in the meantime, effectively keeping that 1864 law in place. All of that sort of confusing procedural history, prompting an awful lot of people to say we need to do something even in the interim to ensure that the 1864 law does not take place in that state. But the governor, of course, the attorney general has said they will pursue no prosecutions of anyone under that 1864 law. But the 2022 law is also getting a lot of attention because it, too, prohibits abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy with no exceptions for rape or incest. Look to Arizona for a lot more action there. Indeed, State Senator Anna Hernandez, who is one of the sponsors of the repeal measure, said, "We are standing in a moment of Arizona history." Certainly that is the case for Arizona as they wrestle with the 1864 law, the 2022 law, and the interplay between a state Supreme Court, legislative action, executive action on this issue. More certainly coming out from the state of Arizona, coming out also from the state of Florida, where once again we have action initiated by a state Supreme Court. This once again is not the federal Supreme Court, it's the state Supreme Court in Florida. A recent Supreme Court decision, this one is 6-1, says that based upon our analysis, finding no clear right to abortion embodied in the privacy clause of the state constitution, the petitioner here cannot overcome the presumption of constitutionality. And therefore, basically keeping in place a Florida ban after six weeks of pregnancy passed by the legislature. Interestingly, in a separate ruling on the same day, same Supreme Court said, even though we're going to find that ban, that six-week pregnancy ban, remains in place, by a separate ruling, by a 4-3 decision, a very much split decision, the state Supreme Court there said that a proposed constitutional amendment, a change in the Constitution of the state of Florida that would guarantee the right to an abortion before viability. That's the language of the proposed constitutional amendment. Usually before viability means around 24 weeks or so. That's the state of the medical condition today. That will be on the ballot in November. And the Supreme Court says, yes, indeed, that can be on the statewide ballot come November. And so that 6 weeks ban on abortions, which is now effective, and it became effective as of May 1, just this past Wednesday. The 6-week ban on abortion is now effective in Florida. And two things will happen. One is that in November, months from now, the people of the state of Florida will go to the polls and determine whether or not they want to override, to supersede that 6-week ban by passing what's called Constitutional Amendment 4. This is the amendment, once again, that allows abortions before viability. That would need more than 60% of the votes in that November polling. So that is coming up. But in the meantime, the 6-week ban remains in place in the state of Florida, prompting an awful lot of advocacy, as in Arizona there, about this constitutional amendment, again, that would establish guaranteeing the right to an abortion before viability, usually around 24 weeks, whether that will become the law and the constitutional standard in the state of Florida, superseding what the legislature previously did. An awful lot of advocacy. We have seen recently the governor there, his name is Ron DeSantis, advocating that the law remain exactly as it is. This was his proposal in the past. This is his legislation passed by the state assembly and the state senate. Nonetheless, he is advocating for the defeat of Constitutional Amendment 4. And you also have others, including our vice president, Kamala Harris, there just this past week, advocating that Constitutional Amendment 4 should be passed by 60% or more of the people of the state of Florida. All of that happening in the states of our country as this issue continues to percolate up undeniably, not just in our courts, not just in our legislature, not just in our executive branches, but yes, indeed, in polling places, this continues to be a major issue. And the Supreme Court, as we indicated earlier in this broadcast, has not gotten out from under the need to address abortion issues. They've got those two cases pending for decision sometime soon in our nation's history. All of that happening in our courts of America. We also spend some time on this broadcast talking about financial crimes and economic crimes and other things affecting the future of our nation. And we talk also about civil liability, things brought by private parties, brought by the government to enforce the civil law, including, yes, that's right, the antitrust laws of our nation. We have not previously focused much, if at all, upon this major case pending right now in the federal district court in the District of Columbia involving Google. It is the strongest challenge by the federal government to so-called big tech's power, and it's nearing its climax right now. Just this past week, closing arguments in the wake of a weeks-long trial, the United States of America, brought by the Antitrust Division of the United States Department of Justice against Google and others. On Thursday and continuing into Friday, lawyers for the Department of Justice, state attorneys general, and Google deliver their final arguments in this years-long case initiated many years ago. It's called the United States and Others versus Google. And the question, again, is whether this tech giant broke federal antitrust laws to maintain its online search dominance. Those arguments concluding now, and now, a decision anticipated by the district court. This case tried, a civil case tried in front of Amit Mehta. We have talked about him because he has been presiding over other cases, other criminal matters involving a completely different subject matter, and that is the insurrection. He presided over many cases involving defendants brought into court by the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia for the insurrection on January 6th. Now he is presiding over this case weeks long about whether or not Google violated our nation's antitrust laws. And he will make a decision presumably sometime in the months ahead. Interesting case, interesting arguments. The government, of course, claims that Google competed unfairly when it paid Apple and some other companies billions of dollars to automatically handle searches on things like smartphones and web browsers. Google, on the other hand, insists, as it did during the course of the trial, during the course of oral argument here, that consumers use its search engines because it is the very best product that is out there. The trial, once again, as I indicated, the biggest challenge to date to the power of today's tech giants, which have defined, frankly, an era in our nation. Billions of people around the world depend on these products for information and for social interaction and commerce. American regulators have also sued Apple and Amazon and Meta in recent years for like monopolistic behaviors. Google's case is likely to set a legal precedent for that group. An awful lot of people looking at this and saying this is the most important decision and the most important antitrust trial of the 21st century. At the heart of the case, again, is Google's dominance in online searches, which generates billions in profits, as we know, annually. The government, once again, the Justice Department, maintaining that Google's search engine conducts nearly 90% of all web searches. The company spent about $26.3 billion in 2021 alone to become the default search engine on browsers like Apple Safari, Firefox, And what that means, at least according to the government, is that it automatically selected for users out of the box those browsers and those search engines, and all of that, again, presented during the course of the trial. Apple's share, about $18 billion, according to an awful lot of reports. It's arguing, again, that those contracts were designed to defend its search business monopoly and hurt the ability of other companies like Microsoft and DuckDuckGo to compete in this area. Now, Judge Mehta, during the course of oral arguments, the closing arguments of recent days, has grilled both sides. And so not a lot of indication, unlike some of the Supreme Court cases that we've talked about, not a lot of indication coming out of Judge Mehta about how he is going to resolve this dispute between Google and its leadership and the leadership of the Department of Justice, the United States of America, trying to poke holes, frankly, in the closing arguments in this landmark monopoly case, questioning the government's argument that Google's dominance had hurt the quality of the experience for searching for information online. Ask them about that, the quality of the product. Didn't this, in fact, enhance in some ways the quality of the online experience, but also pushing back against Google and defending its central argument that it isn't a monopoly because, according to Google and its lawyers, Google uses other companies like Amazon to search for shopping items and TikTok to search for music clips. In other words, pointing directions in other areas. Certainly, I don't think that the average person, Judge Mehta said, would say that Google and Amazon are the same thing. And so Judge Mehta, looking at both sides and wondering aloud whether or not one side or another has the better of the argument. The judge questioned how it would be possible for another company to beat Google out as the search engine that automatically populates for Apple's web browser, Safari. He proposed, for example, that it could be impossible without having billions of dollars to spend to truly build a competitive search engine and billions more to pay Apple. He prodded Google's lead litigator on the argument that companies like Amazon and ESPN are two competitors at the same time to its search engine. He noted, for example, interesting that he wanted to know who the shortstop, that if he wanted to know who the shortstop for the Baltimore Orioles was in 1983, he would most likely use Google. And the point of all of that, this discussion between the judge, Judge Mehta, and the lawyers for the Justice Department and the lawyers for Google, is that he is testing the legitimacy, the strength, the power of the arguments in both sides, interrupting them about issues that he is identifying. Again, no jury here, no jury to decide this case. Judge Mehta will be determining whether or not the allegations of antitrust claims against Google held up. An awful lot of predictions that he is not going to find that Google has engaged in so much violative behavior that it needs to be broken up, but that would be one of the remedies. Unlikely he will do that. He may do some things short of that along the way, some determination about whether or not some things in Google's practices do require some remedial action, some intervention by the courts. Based upon the Justice Department's allegations, are there things short of breaking it up? Should they pay some fines? Should they do some other things in terms of their future operation to address what may or may not in the end be antitrust violations? That will probably come out long after the Supreme Court cases in June are decided. Judge Mehta now has that so-called under advisement. He can make his determination whenever he would like. It is no small thing. Weeks and weeks of trial testimony, of evidence, of documents, of arguments along the way. He's got a lot before him, a lot on his docket. We will continue to monitor that and report back on what the judge says in this Google antitrust case here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
It's 2024 and Worthington, Minnesota continues to shine. We've expanded so many things. It's a time of growth. We've expanded recreation activities with our indoor ice arena, our indoor turf rec center and playground, and our outdoor water park, Waterworld, is ready for another season. Our schools have expanded, and so has our industry. We're continuing to expand our population also, with lots ready to build on Glenwood Heights. So let's grow together in Worthington, Minnesota. It's worth a look.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Talk of Green Bay, 97.9 FM and 1590 AM WGBW, and on the Civic Media app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. This is our final segment of our two-hour broadcast this weekend. Thank you once again for joining me and Calvin, my wonderful producer, for our broadcast this weekend. We are concluding in this, our last segment, by returning, yes, as promised, to that trial going on right now in the Manhattan courtroom, presided over by Judge Juan Merchan. This is a criminal case. It is a state criminal case, not a federal case, brought by the district attorney. His name is Alvin Bragg, alleging that Donald Trump, the singular defendant there, 34 counts of allegations of false statements, false representations, false documents when it came to paying off Stormy Daniels, Karen McDougal, and others for keeping quiet about previous alleged sexual liaisons, relationships before the 2016 election. And again, as I said at the outset of our broadcast this weekend, that's the premise of the presentation by the DA, which is that this is also an election interference case accomplished through the violation of New York law by failing to come forward with accurate reports, invoices, checks, register entries, all those kinds of things. Lots of things going on in this case. And again, we are entering into arguably the third trial. We've had 2 weeks of testimony, not every day. The judge is taking Wednesday off to permit the parties and him to do other things. He also has a docket going on. But we know that from just this past week, we have a number of additional witnesses being presented again as a part of the prosecution case. The prosecution has the obligation, as you know, of presenting evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to prove the allegations in this 34-count charge against Donald Trump. And it's only if they meet that burden beyond a reasonable doubt to the unanimous decision of the jury that's, yes, there in the courtroom there in Manhattan. If they meet that burden, only then, by unanimous verdict, can the defendant, Donald Trump, be found guilty of one or more of those counts. Plainly, there are appellate rights that could follow this as well, which we have also talked about in the New York system, like they are in the federal system. But this past week, again, we have gotten more testimony presented by what? By the prosecution as a part of this case. That includes direct testimony, questions asked by the prosecutor, and then also as a part of our system, cross-examination by the attorneys for Donald Trump. And they have pursued that. And that is the appropriate part of the process. They are there to test the legitimacy, the strength, if you will, the power of the government's case. And so we concluded the previous week with some testimony of, for example, Rona Graff, who was one of the so-called custodial document witnesses, one of the technical witnesses. She's a former executive assistant to Donald Trump. And she came in and she told a number of things about her relationship, obviously, with Donald Trump, and said that, yes, indeed, in the database that the Trump Organization has, at Donald Trump's encouragement, he has information, contact information about both Stormy Daniels and also Karen McDougal, the principal subjects of these payments to them, in some cases through the National Enquirer, in some cases, according to the allegations in the indictment, through Michael Cohen and Donald Trump. She came in and talked about that. And what does she do? She provides a little bit more information to establish this tie, this link, which the government is obliged to show, if it can do it at all, between Donald Trump and his operation and these particular women, she basically establishes that, yes, indeed, there plainly was communication between them, followed by this fellow named Gary Farrow, F-A-R-R-O. He's the financial loan manager for First Republic Bank. And he is also not a direct fact witness, but he comes in and talks about the ways in which he established a predicate loan of $130,000, a home equity loan, that was extended to Michael Cohen, who will be a future witness here, probably next week or maybe the following week or so. He comes in and talks once again. He provides the financial records, the documents, the transactional piece that will support, presumably, what Michael Cohen will say down the road based upon the transaction between Michael Cohen. He gets this home equity loan, $130,000, which he then turns over to Stormy Daniels to pay her off, to be quiet about this previous sexual liaison. So we get those witnesses who are adding more information to the overall story. Independently, any of those witnesses does not establish proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but collectively, as the witnesses go forward, they add more to the story. They add more, they hang more things on the overall story that was told by David Pecker, the first and principal witness up to this time. We also had the testimony just this past week of an attorney named Larry Davidson. If David Pecker talked about the dark side, if you will, of publishing, or at least publishing in the National Enquirer, catching and killing stories, saying things that are not true, publishing things or not publishing things based upon not the legitimate interest in journalism, but upon political motives, Larry Davidson comes in and he talks about how he has clients. And the purpose of his work on their behalf, clients, is to manage things like this. He is the attorney for both Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels. And he comes in and says, yes, he brokered what he called consideration, basically the agreement for their silence in exchange for those monetary payments. He is subject to a lot of cross-examination along the way, and that happens very, very clearly and emphatically. We have Douglas Dowse, who comes in, who provides some forensics for an electronic exchange, a recorded conversation between Michael Cohen and Donald Trump about the Karen McDougal matter. All of that comes in. And then finally, just late this week, the testimony of Hope Hicks. And she comes in and provides more information about what was going on in the context of the Trump campaign 2016 after news of the Access Hollywood tape breaks. I'm going to talk in the future more about credibility of witnesses. I would offer here that Hope Hicks, both in terms of her demeanor and substance, not only provides more information about what was going on at the time, connections with Donald Trump, conversations with all of these players, but also does it in a very compelling way. The final comment I would make is also about something that happened outside of the jury this past week, and that is the judge admonishing the defense and the defendant in particular about his public statements that somehow this so-called gag order, a word that once again makes me bristle, this order that prohibits him from talking about or calling names to witnesses and jurors, somehow prevents Donald Trump from testifying in his own behalf. And yes, indeed, Judge Juan Merchan says in the courtroom late this past week, let me be very clear, and here's the civics lesson from him, and also as we close out on our broadcast, that nothing about the order imposed upon a defendant here in any case prevents a defendant, if he wants to do it, from testifying. That's the right. Nothing prevents the directions of the court from preventing the defendant from testifying. More about those civics lessons from the bench of Judge Juan Merchan, from other courtrooms across our nation, as our civic media broadcast here in Amicus, a law review, continues in the weeks ahead. Stay with us for those discussions. Join us for those discussions. Thank you for being with me this weekend. Have a great week, everybody.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
Welcome, author of Searching for Patty Hearst, a true crime novel, Roger Rappaport, and Wisconsin comedian Tracy Schrader joins me in studio.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights as 7 till 9.
As a federally licensed broadcast company, this civic media station is required by FCC regulations to accept advertising by all qualified candidates for federal office. We also accept ads from state and local candidates. We do screen announcements from issue groups and PACs and exercise discretion in airing announcements with blatantly false claims or outrageous unfounded statements. These announcements do not necessarily reflect the views of civic media, its hosts, or advertisers, and the source of all issue announcements can be found online at our FCC public file.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete civic media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.